Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Darwin's Black Box celebrates new 10th anniversary edition. I'm Robert Crowther, Director of Communications for the Center for Science and Culture. And joining me today is one of the leading intelligent design scientists in the world, Dr. Michael Behe. 10 years ago, Dr. Behe helped to launch the modern intelligent design movement with the publication of his book, Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution. And now his book is celebrating its 10th anniversary. And there is a brand new anniversary edition of the book available, complete with a new afterword by the author. And we're going to talk with him about that today. Well, I'd like to welcome you to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks. It's nice to be with you. I've never done a podcast before.
Well, good. This will be a first for you and a first for our listeners to hear you on the program. Even though most of our listeners have probably read one of the 250,000 copies in print of your book, why don't you briefly tell us just a little bit about the main argument you make in Darwin's Black Box, the idea of irreducible complexity?
Well, it's just that when Darwin came up with his idea of random mutation and natural selection, nothing was known about the basic level of life, the cell and the molecules that run it. But in the past 50 years, science has found that the molecular level of life is extremely complex, much more complex than anybody had thought. And more than just complex, it's something what I have called irreducibly complex. And the idea of irreducible complexity just means that you have a machine or some system that has a number of different parts, and the parts all interact with each other in order to do something that the parts by themselves can't do. And the importance of this is that it's very difficult to see how irreducibly complex systems can be put together. It turns out that the cell is just chock full of irreducibly complex systems, what biologists have termed molecular machines. And they really, really are machines, just like little trucks and little outboard motors and so on. And I argue in the book that because of this problem of irreducible complexity, that these things can't be put together in the gradual way that Darwin thought, then his theory is not a good explanation for them.
Right. And in fact, I gather that Darwin himself kind of predicted that his theory would fall apart based on evidence or ideas like you've brought forward. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. In one chapter in his book, a chapter called Organs of Extreme Perfection and Complication, in which he talked about things like the eye, he said that if it could ever be shown that there was some organ or system which could not possibly be put together by, quote, numerous successive slight modifications, that his theory would break down. And that's exactly what you can't do with irreducibly complex systems, put them together by numerous successive slight modifications and keep the system functioning at the same time.
I want to back up for just a second, because I know before you did or wrote Darwin's Black Box, you'd been doing a lot of research as a scientist. And so what was it, in your early years in your career as a scientist that led you to originally start doubting or be more skeptical of Darwinian evolution?
Well, in my earlier years, my younger days, I thought Darwin's theory was true. That's what I was taught. I had no reason to doubt my professors in college and graduate school. I just thought, it had been explained. And when you study biochemistry like I did, which is the molecular basis of life, you come across these fantastically complex systems. And I would sometimes look at them and say, oh, I wonder how that got put together. Then kind of shrug my shoulders and say, well, somebody must have figured it out. And then go back to my own project. But it wasn't until the late 1980s, I read a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis by an Australian geneticist by the name of Michael Denton. And he was fed up with Darwin's theory, and he essentially attacked it from a scientific point of view and said it had a whole lot of problems that had gone unresolved. And I was really taken aback by this because I had never heard anybody criticize Darwin's theory, certainly not a scientist. And so at that point, I became very interested. I went back to the journals, the science journals and the science library, and then asked that question again. Who has explained these complex systems that you study in biochemistry? And I was really astounded to find that, in fact, nobody had. There were no published papers showing how wow. random mutation and natural selection could put complex systems together. It turned out that everybody was just assuming the answer and telling everybody else that we already knew it, but it wasn't true.
So your book then was one of the first that really tackled this subject in a major way.
Yes, it's the first one that has specifically focused on the molecular foundation of life. Michael Denton's book looked at a lot of different things. He talked a little bit about molecules, but not so much. He talked about the fossil record and other things too. Mm-hmm. But I think the key to determining just how much Darwin's mechanism of random mutation and natural selection can do and how much it can't do is to be found at the molecular level of life, because everything has to happen there. That's kind of where the rubber meets the road in life. Just like in a computer, the real work gets done at a microscopic level in these tiny circuits inside a computer chip. Well, in life, it gets done by molecules that you can't see. And what's more, any mutation that has to happen for some Darwinian process to go forward would have to be a change in a molecule, in DNA, a change in DNA or a change in proteins. And so to judge what it can and can't do, what random mutation can and can't do, you have to look at molecules. And it turns out when you do, Darwin's theory has big troubles there.
Right. And I know that in the past decade, there's been obviously a lot more research at the molecular level, I guess. And I know that your book specifically has led to a tremendous amount of discussion and debate among scientists about irreducible complexity. And I know that there have even been some attempts by scientists to refute your claims. How successful have those been?
Well, they have been resoundingly unsuccessful. There's been a lot of smoke blown and so on, but when you go to the literature again, you ask yourself, well, okay, now it's been 10 years since my book first came out. Where are those papers now in the journals that show how, say, the psyllium could be put together or the blood clotting system? And they still aren't there, despite the fact that a significant chunk of the scientific community really does not like this idea one bit whatsoever and is very strongly motivated to try and show it to be wrong. There are just essentially brief speculations about how this might have happened, but nothing more than the just-so stories that Darwinians have always been coming up with. I talked about the psyllium. That was the first molecular machine that I discussed in Darwin's Black Box, and it's this little hair-like thing that is actually a very complex molecular machine. It waves back and forth, and it can help cells to swim or can move liquid over the surface of cells. Mm-hmm. And 10 years later, there was published a paper that had the title Speculations on the Origins of Psyllium. So here's 10 years later, and a lot of scientists really blowing smoke over this idea of intelligent design and irreducible complexity. And the best somebody can come up with are speculations about how some of these things might have been put together. So the short answer is that there has been absolutely no progress on explaining these things in a Darwinian fashion.
Wow. In the afterword, you have a new afterword to the anniversary edition of the book. You make a comment that maybe relates to some of this, what you said about speculation. You write, "If it serves their cause, there is no argument too zany for some Darwinian acolytes to certify."
Yeah.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, yeah, that was kind of in the context of discussing the concept of irreducible complexity. A guy named Robert Pennock, who's a philosophy of science professor at Michigan State, had come up with this really, well, I called it zany argument, where he says, well, suppose if you had a complex watch called a chronometer, he says if you broke it a little bit, you could still use this watch, this chronometer, as a regular watch on land. Chronometers are used by sailors to tell longitude at sea. And then he says, well, you know, how do you get a chronometer, though? Well, you can just start with a watch. So here's the argument. You know, you start with a chronometer, break it to get a watch, and then you take a watch and you make a chronometer out of it. And somehow, that you know, there's this spinning circularity here, and he never actually explains anything. And yet, his book has been recommended for the public to read to understand these issues by no less than the National Academy of Sciences. So it's something that you run into, is that the scientific organizations, a lot of them, close ranks against the idea of intelligent design, and they will support any argument, whether it got any value or not, if they think it can be useful in the argument.
Right. And they make kind of doctrinal statements about things that are meant to keep scientists in line, I guess, and yet we're seeing, and you're probably seeing too, a number of young scientists, the next generation of scientists coming up. And you write about the fact that many of those young scientists from all sorts of disciplines are now doing, you know, looking more into scientific theory of intelligent design than ever before. So I'm wondering what you think that means for science and maybe even for the National Academy of Sciences in the coming decades.
Yeah, that's a good point. Older scientists get set in their ways of thinking, but simply the fact that the controversy over intelligent design has been discussed and is kind of in the air as a public topic, younger men and women going into science hear about it, and they don't have this visceral emotional reaction that some older scientists do. And they get intrigued by it, because if you look at these complex systems in the cell and so on, intelligent design is something that pops into your head right away. It's not something that's hard to see. And so I get emails and a lot of private communications by younger scientists interested in the idea. And it's also interesting that in the afterword to the 10th anniversary edition of Darwin's Black Box, I point to an article, that news item that appeared in Nature, the leading science journal in the world, essentially saying that at this conference of Nobel laureates and up-and-coming students, that a number of students were asking the Nobel laureates about this theory of intelligent design, much to their consternation. So I thought that was a promising sign for the future.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us a little bit about the book, Mike. I know that you are going to be the guest of honor at the Center for Science and Culture's 10th anniversary dinner, because the center shares an anniversary with your book, Darwin's Black Box. And that will be in October here in Seattle. Can you give us a little hint of what you might be talking about there?
Well, it's kind of going to be a reflective looking back over the past 10 years and then looking forward. And I'm hoping to tell people why there's every expectation that the future of intelligent design is very bright indeed.
Well, that's great. Again, I want to thank you, and congratulations on the 10th anniversary edition of Darwin's Black Box. The book is out now, available in bookstores and online, and you can also order copies by calling 1-800-643-4102. That's 800-643-4102. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm Robert Crowther for IDTF at the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Finn. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.